In our first story, Behind Mansion Walls. In the golden age of giving, a noble family shares its fortune.
Public service was something that was just expected.
Until greed destroys the legacy.
She just never seemed to have enough. She always wanted more.
And later, when wealth is an addiction.
We need more money. Let's get more money.
Some will sell their souls to get a hit.
Like most evils in the world, this was all motivated by greed.
We can understand murder in a highly charged emotional circumstance. But murder for money, murder for wealth is so cold.
I'm Christopher Mason. Behind mansion walls, there's no crime in having millions of dollars. It's how you acquire them that's important. Honestly, or with a touch of fatal greed.
Modern America, where the rich get richer and the poor get subprime loans. In the days of greed is good, sharks in suits make money from money, billions out of numbers on a screen. And the most a lot of them give back to the community is a few bucks to polish the Bentley.
We all know the story. Good people lose their homes while the bankers walk away with gigantic bonuses. But it wasn't always like this. There was a time when wealth was derived by actually building things that benefited the community.
Duluth, Minnesota is one of the towns that built America. The mining and timber boom here in the late 19th century fuels an explosion of industry, turning ordinary men into tycoons. By 1905, there are more millionaires in Duluth than in any other city in the country. And the richest of them all is Chester Aldgate Condon.
Chester developed his wealth through iron ore properties. He was a timber baron. He was into copper mining in the Arizona area. He was the wealthiest person in Minnesota.
For a hard-working religious man like Chester, greed is a sin. He believes it's the duty of the wealthy to contribute to society.
The Congdon name is so synonymous with philanthropy in the Duluth area that there's Congdon Park, Congdon Boulevard, Congdon School. The Congdon name is synonymous with Duluth because of the great wealth that the family had and the great wealth that they gave away, really, to this region.
And Chester makes sure his children follow the example.
Public service was something that was just expected of the family, and yet it was done in a very unassuming, very natural way, and never done for publicity.
The youngest daughter, Elizabeth, dedicates her life to helping the poor, serving as president of the local junior league.
This woman contributed so much to the community over the years.
After her father dies, Elizabeth takes over the family mansion and the Congdon legacy of philanthropy. When the Great Depression hits and the fat cats tighten their belts, Elizabeth Congdon keeps on giving.
Hello, Marjorie.
Elizabeth never married, but in the 1930s, she actually adopted two daughters, Marjorie and Jennifer, and raised them there at the mansion.
Elizabeth's generosity transports these girls from the poorhouse to the lap of luxury.
The Congdon estate, Glen Sheen, makes modern-day mansions look rather puny. We're talking 39 rooms of old money opulence. Stained glass windows, hand-woven tapestries, silk, damask wallpaper. Elizabeth's daughters take piano lessons on a Steinway grand and roller skate down marble hallways.
I just can't imagine having that much wealth and that much opportunity.
But too much privilege can have fatal consequences. The elder daughter, Marjorie, always wants more.
Elizabeth Congdon did everything for this daughter, but With all of that, with that silver spoon that was placed in her mouth by adoption, nothing could be enough.
You don't love me, do you?
Marjorie, from an early age, showed signs of classic sociopathic behavior. She would steal from her mother's purse, steal money. She would take her mother's credit cards and charge at the Duluth department stores. When the stores tried to take the cards away or stop her, she would forge her mother's signature.
But Elizabeth's generosity knows no limit.
If you need it, you know you want.
She keeps the handouts coming and settles Marjorie's debts to uphold the family's good name.
Marjorie spent money she didn't have, and she turned to her mother for help, that Elizabeth would give her daughter the money that she needed. And this is a pattern that just continued as Marjorie got married and moved on with her life. Mom was always there to bail her out.
March 20th, 1976. 43-year-old Marjorie marries Roger Caldwell. He's an unemployed alcoholic from Pennsylvania. But that doesn't stop him from dreaming.
Roger styles himself as a wealthy rancher with a taste for turquoise jewelry. One of the Congdons dubs him the Rhinestone Cowboy. He and Marjorie are kindred spirits, bonded by a mutual passion. Fraud.
Roger and Marjorie use the Congdon name to fool creditors into giving them loans.
They were going around with real estate agents in the mountains looking at ranches, and they told the real estate agent that their mother would be helping them buy a ranch real soon.
You know I wouldn't ask for it if I didn't really need it.
After Elizabeth suffers a stroke, she needs round-the-clock care. But instead of nursing her, Marjorie takes advantage of her mother's vulnerability and convinces her to sign over more money.
We really need this loan, Mother.
Elizabeth is too generous to say no.
Thank you, Mother.
It didn't matter what the family said to Elizabeth, and they strongly urged her to stop helping Marjorie. She wouldn't do it.
But Elizabeth isn't the only one with keys to the vault. The trustees of the Congdon estate have the authority to stop the payments. And they say enough is enough.
The trustees cut Marjorie off completely. He said no more money. So Marjorie, who'd grown up the mansion living on the shores of Lake Superior, had money all her life, suddenly found herself living in Denver with her new husband, and they were broke.
Marjorie's husband, Roger, is not happy. He's just gotten used to the life of a big spender, living off his mother-in-law's handouts. He lobbies the trustees, but they refuse to release the cash flow he wants.
Roger had been there a month before and had been turned down.
But he finds out something about Elizabeth Congdon's will that changes everything. When she dies, Marjorie will inherit more than $8 million. And the trustees have no power to change that.
Elizabeth was the last surviving child of Chester Congdon, and so she was worth tens of millions of dollars.
Roger Caldwell wanted to speed up the inheritance of the family fortune.
Generous Elizabeth, who never hesitated to share her wealth, is perhaps only a few years from dying a natural death.
But that's not quick enough to satisfy fatal greed. If Roger kills her now, his debts will be cleared, and he'll be set for life.
On June 24th, Marjorie pens in her own handwriting a document which gives Roger Caldwell $2.5 million of her inheritance upon the death of her mother. 3 days later, her mother's dead.
Lurking in the private woodlands of the Congdon family estate in Duluth, Minnesota, is a man consumed by fatal greed.
He was watching the mansion for the lights to go out.
Roger Caldwell wants to fast-track his wife Marjorie's inheritance to cover their massive debts and set them up for a life of luxury.
It was nothing more than greed and not being willing to wait for the inheritance that set things in motion.
To get the payout, he's willing to murder his helpless mother-in-law, Elizabeth Congdon, who spent her life helping the needy. She's 83 years old and partially paralyzed. It should be an easy kill. But there's one thing Roger hasn't thought of. Someone else is in the mansion that night.
Thelma Pietola was the nurse on duty that night, and she heard something out on the stairway and went with a flashlight to investigate.
There was a battle on that staircase.
Roger knocks the nurse down, but it's not over yet.
He heard the nurse still moaning and crying, so he took a candlestick holder from the top of the stairs and went back and finished her off.
Blinded by greed, Roger has become a monster, and the worst is yet to come. Now, poor Elizabeth, who gave everything, is about to have her life stolen from her.
She resisted to the point where her nose was abraded. The skin had come off her nose from rubbing her face on the bottom of the pillow.
Two elderly women shown no mercy by a money-hungry murderer. He even slips the jewelry from his mother-in-law's lifeless hands. Then, Roger ransacks the house and escapes into the night.
On June 27, 1977, when the bodies of Elizabeth Cungan and Velma Pietola were discovered, it sent shockwaves across Duluth, across this entire region, across the entire state. It was part of front page news as far away as Hawaii.
Everyone wants to know, who killed Elizabeth Cungan? It's not long before suspicion falls on Roger Caldwell.
Shortly after I arrived there, the other two detectives told me about what they were hearing about Marjorie and Roger and their financial problems.
Cungan family members tell investigators they believe Roger Caldwell is involved. And Roger has left some telltale signs at the scene.
We had physical evidence that placed Roger Caldwell at the murder scene as well. Some comparison of hair evidence and some blood evidence.
But something doesn't add up.
Roger had only been to the mansion once in his life and had only been into the lower level, had never been upstairs to the bedrooms, and really wouldn't have had a good firsthand knowledge of the layout of the mansion.
With 39 rooms to choose from, how did Roger know exactly where to find Elizabeth?
And then the Cungan family drops a bombshell. This is not the first attempt on Elizabeth's life.
3 years earlier, Elizabeth became seriously ill after eating homemade marmalade. The next day, a powerful sedative, not on Elizabeth's schedule of medications, was discovered in her system. Whispers at the time suggested her daughter Marjorie may have been involved.
The family found out about it through a blood test.
Detective Gary Waller recalls the shocking revelation that cast a cloud of suspicion over Marjorie. The family suspected foul play, but they chose not to alert the authorities. It seems that may have been a grave mistake.
The family never ever brought this to our attention in 1974. Wealthy families. They don't want people looking inside. You know, they take care of things themselves, but they could hardly take care of two dead bodies in the house.
And on top of that,
this could blow the case wide open.
All we have to do is get inside the house. That's
detectives hatch a theory.
Got to do this now. So,
they now believe Roger and Marjorie could be involved in the murders.
These things can put my neck in a noose.
I overheard some of the police officers talking about Colorado.
We need to just chill.
Put my neck's on the line.
Detectives get a tip. that Roger and Marjorie are living in a motel room in Denver.
You have no respect whatsoever.
The cops have a search warrant, and it doesn't take them long to hit the jackpot.
Fruits of the crime are actually in their possession.
Looks like it'll be an easy bust.
I see it time and time again. When greed is the motive, caution goes out the window. Rather than cover his tracks, Roger stamps his telltale footprints where everyone can see them.
An envelope with his handwriting on it was postmarked in Duluth the day of the murders and mailed to Roger and Marjorie's hotel room in Denver.
Inside the envelope is an ancient gold coin from Elizabeth Congdon's private collection. Cops believe it was a signal from Roger to Marjorie to tell her the job had been done.
With that postmark, they were able to prove that Roger was actually in Duluth on the day of the murders.
Roger denies everything, but analysis of the envelope will later reveal his thumbprint.
If there's one thing that cops like almost better than the truth, it's a good lie that we can prove is a lie.
Detective Waller isn't impressed by Marjorie's performance either.
That's amazing, isn't it? Most of it's fake.
My first instinct was that she was manipulative.
No.
That she thought she was smarter than us.
The early evidence suggests that Marjorie may be involved, but that case will take time to build. For now, they arrest Roger, and he goes on trial for murder. The evidence against him is piled high as the Glen Sheen Mansion rooftop.
He was in possession of the goods stolen from the mansion. His blood was found at the scene of the murders. We had hair evidence, and we had this contract. This document written by Marjorie 3 days before the murders on June 24th, 1977, that gave Roger $2.5 million of her $8 million inheritance upon the death of her mother. And they both signed off on it. It's a contract.
July 10th, 1978. Roger Caldwell gets back-to-back life sentences for two counts of first-degree murder. Emboldened by the result, the next day, Minnesota authorities arrest Marjorie on murder and conspiracy charges. Marjorie commits over $1 million of her future inheritance to a top attorney and some expert testimony to defend herself.
She was able to afford some of the same expert witnesses at her trial that O.J. Simpson had at his trial.
In Marjorie's trial, there was some new evidence that popped up, including an expert who said maybe that thumbprint that helped convict Roger really wasn't Roger's thumbprint.
Marjorie's legal team casts reasonable doubt all over the evidence from Roger's trial, blowing the prosecution's case apart. Marjorie is acquitted of all charges and walks free. Those who had questioned her innocence are left to rethink their suspicions. Was Roger acting alone after all?
Here's the deal. Only one person knows for sure if Marjorie was the mastermind. Roger Caldwell. And he's not talking.
Based on Marjorie's lawyer's thrashing of the evidence that convicted Roger, Caldwell appeals his sentence and is offered an incredible plea bargain. If he signs a confession for second-degree murder, he'll walk free based on time already served. Or he can go back to trial.
He said he thought about it for about 3 or 4 seconds and said, "Where do I sign?"
Justice was not served by the plea bargain. For Roger Caldwell to only spend 5 years in prison for these horrific murders of Elizabeth Congdon and her nurse, justice wasn't done.
In his confession, Roger doesn't point the finger at Marjorie or provide any new information.
He always just stuck to the very basic outline of breaking into the house, surprising the nurse on the stairway, and going up and killing Miss Congdon.
In the end, Roger never saw any of the spoils from that fateful night. And Marjorie only received about a quarter of her inheritance. Most of it went to the lawyers. In the game of fatal greed, everybody loses.
This was a crime committed for greed, truly fatal greed.
Back in Duluth, the locals still mourn the loss of their great benefactor, Elizabeth Congdon. With her death, the golden era of giving comes to a tragic end, and the days of greed is good begin.
After years of waiting in vain for his share of the Congdon fortune, Roger Caldwell kills himself in despair. Today, Marjorie Congdon lives in Tucson, Arizona, on probation for fraud.
The Congdon name still holds its place in Minnesota history, with some memories happier than others. Still to come, behind mansion walls, for the princes of Beverly Hills, a lavish lifestyle is a birthright.
They spent money on anything they wanted to spend money on.
But for an exclusive band of brothers, too much is not enough. And they'll learn that the con game is not for boys.
This was way more than any of these kids had bargained for.
Welcome to Hollywood, where dreams come true. You can reinvent yourself in this town. Just ask Joe Hunt.
His name used to be Joe Gamsky, but he changed it to Hunt because that name has a rich lineage. The Hunt family of Texas is one of the wealthiest oil dynasties in history. The perfect profile for the kind of guy Joe Hunt wants to become. A billionaire.
Joe Hunt went to Harvard Boys School, and his parents did not have any money. He saw all this wealth there, and of course, the first thing that he was thinking of is the wealth and how he was amongst the wealth and wanted to be part of the wealth.
Joe's real family doesn't have an oil fortune. Luckily, he's a gifted student and has his tuition paid through a scholarship. But his humble roots make him an outcast of the exclusive Harvard School for Boys.
Joe was a scholarship kid surrounded by rich kids. And I think that shaped him a lot, that sense of being both the smartest kid in the room and the poorest kid in the room.
He definitely thought that he deserved everything that they had, money, and he was going to do no matter what he had to do to accomplish that.
Joe plans to get rich quick, the Wall Street way. So he races through a business degree, then heads to Chicago and works as a commodities trader, buying and selling bulk goods on the international market. After a year, he thinks he's Gordon Gekko and decides to start his own company. But first, he needs money.
He thought that if he just had money, he was smarter than anybody else. He could go put it into the commodities market. And because he was smarter than anybody else, he would succeed.
Then, Joe has a revelation. His Silver Spoon schoolmates could connect him to the startup cash he needs.
The idea was really to bring a bunch of kids with a lot of good contacts, affluent parents, affluent friends, to attract investors.
Back in Beverly Hills, he tracks down popular former classmate Dean Kearney and lays on the sales pitch.
Joe Hunt said that he was doing trades on the Chicago Mercantile and was bragging about all that he had done.
Dean is impressed and agrees to help Joe with the venture. He'll round up some wealthy Harvard schoolboys, and Joe will deliver the spiel. With his mastery of commodities trading, he'll turn their trust funds into fortunes, and make them partners in a new investment group he calls the Billionaire Boys Club. BBC for short.
It's all about money, right?
Yeah.
All right, this is about money.
Joe is a smooth-talking salesman, and he's found the perfect incentive for these idle sons of wealth.
A lot of the kids in the BBC were kind of lost. They weren't quite sure what they were going to do next. And here was Joe saying, it's okay, you don't have to start at the bottom. We can all start at the top. And we'll be extremely wealthy without ever really having to work very hard for it.
Joe plants the seed, and greed does the rest. The BBC boys think Joe will make them rich beyond their wildest dreams.
Once he got the trust of these boys, he used it to his advantage. He would talk them into getting money from their parents, getting money from friends. I mean, he was getting all kinds of money.
Joe invests some of the money, but he spends just as much on his lavish lifestyle.
He was funding his personal life, the boys' personal lives. They were getting apartments at the Wilshire Manning. I mean, they were all over the place just spending money that wasn't their money.
Meanwhile, Joe's trades aren't getting the huge returns he promised. In fact, he's losing money fast. But he knows how to fix that.
He would doctor up the statements after each month, and it looked like they were doing very well with their investments.
By faking the impressive returns, Joe maintains a steady flow of eager investors.
Joe Hunt's School of Finance sounds more Bernie Madoff than Gordon Gekko. He's not only robbing Peter to pay Paul, he's robbing them both to pay himself. A classic Ponzi scheme.
When people asked to get paid, he would pay by getting other people's money.
He didn't hesitate to lie, to cheat. He continued to live in the style that he was becoming accustomed, without letting them know that really their money was just gone.
Japan, I love Japan.
And even when some folks get burned, Joe's smooth talk keeps their wallets wide open.
Dean Carney's parents put $50,000 in and lost it, and Joe actually talked them into investing another $50,000 or so. I mean, that's how good he was.
Happy, so you should be happy.
Joe's tactics have placed him on a slippery slope, but he still thinks he can win big the Wall Street way, like a true player.
He still believed at that point that if he just had enough money to put in the commodities market, he could make a killing.
Then, a golden opportunity knocks. Joe lands a whale of an investor in Beverly Hills big shot, Ron Levin. Levin is a notorious player, and he sees a lot of potential in Joe Hunt.
I like your presentation. It's missing one thing.
He lays down $5 million for Joe to invest as he pleases.
I like that too. Maybe you okay with that figure? I love it, Ron. Awesome.
Joe gets a chance to wipe out all his debts and make some real life super profits for the Billionaire Boys Club. But he has no idea what he's getting himself into. In the great age of American industry, bold young entrepreneurs built modern wonders to rival the ancient pyramids. In the 1980s, they built pyramid schemes. Smooth-talking Joe Hunt is a poster child for this era of excess.
Joe Hunt acquired a lifestyle before he really acquired a living.
Joe thinks he's a Top Gun trader and that the commodities market is his private ATM. But so far, he's on a losing streak. Then, Beverly Hills player Ron Levin gives Joe a $5 million chance to prove himself. But there's a catch. Joe can only trade the money through Ron's personal brokerage account.
Joe worked with the brokers there and invested the money in the commodities market. And he was getting these statements every month showing that he was making lots and lots of money.
He was doubling and tripling this money, and Joe Hunt was just ecstatic. He was bragging to everybody about all this money that he was making.
I know you know, but hey, let's get into it.
At last, Joe is the runaway success he always knew he would be. The account statements show he's turned Ron's $5 million into almost $14 million. More than $8 million profit. For now, it's just numbers on a page. But that's not going to stop him spending. Big time. BBC company policy is buy now, pay later.
He went out and bought a motorcycle, went out to these big dinners and clothes and so on and so forth. And they had cars. I mean, they had nice cars. So it was just no limit to the money that they spent.
They did a lot of celebrating. They lived very well during that period. But then things started to go south. Ron Levin kept not coming up with the money. Joe would say to him, we've made all this money, half of it is mine. You get half, I get half. I want the money. And Ron kept saying, yes, soon, yes, soon. And this went on for weeks.
There's something about Ron Levin that Joe should have thought of before making any deals.
Ron Levin was one of the purest con men ever to live. His whole life was about conning other people.
Con Man 101, pop quiz. How do you get Louis Vuitton luggage for free? Well, this is how Ron Levin did it. Take a Rolls Royce for a test drive, pull up to the Louis Vuitton boutique in Beverly Hills. Tell them you'd like to see how many bags you can fit in the Rolls. Load it to the brim, and then drive off.
If he had to give back everything that he'd gotten through scams, he wouldn't have anything.
Ron has scammed Joe, but he hasn't done it for money. He's done it for fun.
Ron Levin lived for amusement, and the BBC boys amused him. He thought of them as just kind of this temporary little amusement in his life.
One night, alone at the office, Joe Hunt finally learns the truth. Ron can't pay him his cut of the $8 million in profits because they don't exist.
Pick up the phone.
Ron's $5 million investment account was a phony, and the brokers Joe thought he was trading with were in on the joke.
The entire investment had been a scam. There was no money from the start. And what Joe Hunt thought were real earnings only on paper.
Looks like Conman Jr. got outsmarted by Conman Sr. To Ron, it's just a harmless bit of fun between colleagues. But Joe is not laughing.
It made him look like a fool within the Billionaire Boys Club. I mean, here he is bragging that they've made all this money, he's going around, he's dancing around the office, showing the statements, and being the big shot, and now he's looking like a fool.
The BBC has spent millions on false credit, and there's an ever-growing list of investors waiting to get paid. But Joe has a plan to hide the truth and save the BBC from collapse. He'll rob Ron Levin of every cent he has and guarantee his silence with a bullet.
Joe Hunt was very methodical. He did to-do lists for everything. So when he decided to kill Ron Levin, he made a to-do list. On a yellow legal pad, he wrote out things like kill dog, tape mouth, close curtains.
It was a to-do list to kill somebody.
Joe confides his plan to BBC co-founder Dean Carney. But he knows Pretty Boy Dean isn't the right man for the job. Joe has someone else in mind. The BBC bodyguard, Jim Pittman, a former bodybuilder with a fondness for guns.
After making his careful to-do list, Joe Hunt and Jim Pittman went to Ron Levin's house one night.
Ron barters for his life with all the money he has in an offshore account.
They made Ron Levin sign a check for $1.5 million on a Swiss bank account because he had blank checks.
But it's the last check Ron Levin will ever sign. Joe Hunt's greed made him blind to risk. He thought he was a player, but he got played by a notorious con man, Ron Levin.
Joe should have seen the signs. Ron Levin bragged that he had scammed everything that he owned in life.
Ron Levin pays with his life. The BBC gets a $1.5 million payout, or so they think. The boys head to Soledad Canyon, about an hour out of Los Angeles, to dump Levin's corpse. In this remote location, it's unlikely the body will ever be found. But they're not taking any risks. They shoot up Ron Levin's face to disguise his identity.
In the game of fatal greed, Joe Hunt has graduated with flying colors. At first, he conned investors into bankrolling his ambitions and his lifestyle. Then he lied and cheated to cover his debts. Now, he murders for money.
Back in Beverly Hills, Joe Hunt tries to cash in his blood ransom. The $1.5 million should be just enough to keep the BBC afloat.
The check that Ron Levin signed over to Joe Hunt for $1.5 million on a Swiss bank account, Joe thought was going to save them.
But even from beyond the grave, trickster Ron Levin has one more surprise for the Billionaire Boys Club.
There wasn't any money in that account. It was an account that Ron Levin had had because there was status in having a Swiss bank account.
Joe Hunt is devastated and fresh out of ideas. With no money coming in, the BBC rank and file are losing faith.
The whole BBC was on the verge of collapse. People were starting just not to believe in Joe Hunt anymore.
Then, out of the blue, Joe gets a lifeline. A new BBC recruit, Reza Eslaminia, is eager to impress, and he says he knows a way to turn around the BBC's fortunes.
Joe and BBC co-founder Dean Carney believe their new club member, Reza, could provide an avenue to millions of dollars. All their money troubles could be over in one hit. Reza Eslaminia is a wealthy son of privilege. His father, Hedayat Eslaminia, is a rich Iranian dignitary living in Northern California. A key state's witness will later allege that Joe planned to force Hedayat to sign over his assets to his son, Reza.
Reza promised that he would share this with the BBC. Everyone would be happy.
Everyone except Hedayat Eslaminia.
The plan was to kidnap Hedayat Eslaminia and then torture him until he gave up his money.
It's a desperate plan, but if they can just pull it off, they'll all be in the clear. Hunt believes Reza's father is worth $30 million.
They put him in the back of a U-Haul van that they'd rented. They drove him down to Los Angeles, but halfway down, he died in the trunk before they'd gotten him to sign over anything to his son, before they'd managed to do anything.
If two people hadn't died in gruesome circumstances, you'd call this a comedy of errors.
Down here, down here.
Now they're trying to figure out what to do with him, and they decide that, let's take him up to the hills where we buried Ron Levin.
Every one of Joe's plots to get rich has failed, but fatal greed knows no bounds. He still thinks he can get his hands on the wealthy Iranian's fortune.
Go get the sucker's money.
Joe went to plan B, which was trying to get Reza Eslaminia to get his father's assets, to have him declared missing, to take over his assets.
But is it too late to save the Billionaire Boys Club?
Mr. Hunt.
September 28th, 1984. Joe Hunt gets a visit from Detective Les Zoller, the lead investigator in the disappearance of Ron Levin.
Do you know this man? Yeah, that's an old business associate of mine. How is O'Reilly?
Well, as a matter of fact,
Joe plays it cool.
Yeah,
But the detective has an ace up his sleeve.
Know anything about that list?
When Detective Zoller searched Ron Levin's house, he found something that Joe Hunt should have buried along with the body.
Joe Hunt's to-do list, which Joe Hunt had left behind the night that they killed Ron Levin.
Oops. Perhaps the last item on that list should have been, don't leave the list behind. A bit of an oversight, wouldn't you say?
I would say that that was a pretty major oversight.
You wrote this list, didn't you?
I'm not going to say anything more until I have a lawyer.
So are you saying this is not your handwriting?
I have nothing to say.
Well, I'm seeing you, boy.
I gave him a copy of this 7-page to-do list. And I said, what can you tell us about that? And he starts looking at it, and his whole demeanor changed.
Joe's to-do list is vital in incriminating evidence, but it's only the beginning. The whole corrupt empire of the Billionaire Boys Club is about to be blown to pieces from within.
Dean Carney got to a point where he realized what he was involved in, and he couldn't live with himself.
Dean Carney spills the beans on the entire operation.
Dean Carney was one of the few people that had the full knowledge of what was going on in the Billionaire Boys Club.
He takes Detective Zoller up to Soledad Canyon to look for the bodies. By the time they find Hedayat Eslaminia's remains, they've been ravaged by coyotes. Ron Levin's body is never found.
The to-do list was probably the most important piece of physical evidence. Dean Carney's testimony was what drove the nail into Joe Hunt's coffin, though.
Joe Hunt is convicted of the murder of Ron Levin and sentenced to life without parole. But his trial for the kidnapping and death of Hedayat Eslaminia is dismissed when the jury deadlocks. After two juries deadlock in Jim Pittman's trials, he takes a plea bargain for accessory after the fact to the murder of Ron Levin and gets 3.5 years in prison. Then, in a television interview after his release, he admits to the murder, knowing he can't be tried again because of double jeopardy. Dean Carney enters witness protection and is given a new identity.
Joe Hunt wanted to be a billionaire. Then he racked up massive debts and became a murderer instead. But he still dreams of success. In Folsom Prison, California, Joe has reinvented himself yet again as an author of fantasy fiction. Perhaps in his stories, he's finally the billionaire he could never be in real life. Joe Hunt was a bright young man who could have made a good living if only he'd been willing to work for it. Marjorie Congdon was given everything by a loving benefactor, but it would never be enough. Standing between them and money was a dangerous place to be. Their lives were driven by fatal greed. Till next we meet, behind Mansion Walls, I'm Christopher Mason.